Side 12, The Sapphire Rose by David Eddings, continuing on page 405.
Slide that wall back in place, Sparhawk said, and see if you can find some way to wedge it shut.
We can do that from up above, Ewoth said. We'll block the track it slides on.
Sparhawk grunted as he made some decisions.
Babier, he said regretfully, we're going to have to leave you here, I'm afraid. You're badly wounded, and I've already lost enough friends today.
Babier started to object, but then changed his mind.
Talon, Sparhawk went on, you stay here with Babier and your father.
He smiled a sad smile.
We want to kill Azash. We don't want to steal him.
Talon nodded.
And Bayret.
Please, Sparhawk, the young man said, his eyes filled with tears. Please don't make me stay behind.
Sir Babier and Talon are safe here, and I might be able to help when we get to the temple.
Sparhawk glanced at Sophronia. She nodded.
All right, he said.
He wanted to warn Bayret to be careful, but that would have demeaned the apprentice, so he let it pass.
Give me your war axe and shield, Bayret,
Babier said, his voice weak.
Take these instead.
He handed Bayret his lachaber and his burnished shield.
I won't dishonor them, Sir Babier,
Bayret swore.
Colton had stepped toward the rear of the chamber.
There's a space back here under the stairs, Babier. It might be a good idea for you and Curic and Talon to wait for us under there. If the soldiers manage to break through the wall, the three of you won't be in plain sight.
Babier nodded, as Ewoth took up Curic's body to conceal it behind the stairs.
There's not much left to say, Babier, Sparhawk told the Cyrenic knight, taking his hand. We'll try to come back as soon as we can.
I'll pray for you, Sparhawk,
Babier said.
For all of you.
Sparhawk nodded, then knelt briefly at Curic's side and took his squire's hand.
Sleep well, my friend, he murmured.
Then he rose and started up the stairs without looking back. The stairs at the far end of that broad, straight pathway that stretched across the mole-tunnel mounds of the labyrinth below were very wide and sheathed with marble. There was no sliding wall to conceal a chamber at the foot of those stairs, and no maze led away from the temple. No maze was needed.
Wait here, Sparhawk whispered to his friends, and put out those torches.
He crept forward, pulled off his helmet, and laid down at the top of the stairs.
Ewoth, he murmured, hold my ankles. I want to see what we're getting into.
With the huge Thalesian keeping him from tumbling in a steely clatter down the stairs, Sparhawk inched his way headfirst down the stairs until he could see out into the room beyond. The Temple of Azash was a place of nightmare. It was, as the dome that roofed it implied, circular, and it was fully a half a mile across. The curving, inwardly sloping walls were of polished black onyx, as was the floor. It was much like looking into the very heart of night. The temple was not lighted by torches, but by huge bonfires flaring and roaring in enormous iron basins set on girder-like legs. The vast chamber was encircled by tier upon tier of polished black terraces, stepping down and down to a black floor far beneath. At evenly spaced intervals along the top terrace were 20-foot marble statues of things that were for the most part not human. Then Sparhawk saw a Styric form among them, and somewhat farther along, an Elanian one. He realized that the statues were representations of the servants of Azash, and that humanity played a very small and insignificant part in that assemblage. The other servants dwelt in places at once very far away, and at the same time very, very close. Directly opposite the entrance through which he peered was the towering idol. Man's efforts to visualize and to represent his gods are never wholly satisfactory. A lion-headed god is not really the image of a human body with the head of a lion tacked on for the sake of contrast. Mankind perceives the face as the seat of the soul. The body is largely irrelevant. The icon of a god is not meant to be representational, and the face of the icon is intended to suggest the spirit of the god rather than to be an accurate recreation of his real features. The face of the idol, rearing high above the polished black temple, contained the sum of human depravity. Lust was there, certainly, and greed and gluttony. But there were other attributes in that face as well, attributes for which there were no names in any human tongue. Azash, to judge from his face, craved, required, things beyond human comprehension. There was a haggard, unsatisfied look about that face. It was the face of a being with overpowering desires that were not, could not be, satisfied. The lips were twisted, the eyes brooding and cruel. Sparhawk wrenched his eyes from that face. To look too long at it was to lose one's soul. The body was not fully formed. It was as if the sculptor had been so overwhelmed by that face and all that it implied that he no more than sketched in the remainder of the figure. There was a spider-like profusion of arms that extended in clusters of tentacles from vast shoulders. The body leaned back somewhat with its hips thrust forward obscenely, but what would have been the focus of that suggestive pose was not there. Instead, there was a smooth, unwrinkled surface, shiny and looking very much like a burn scar. Sparhawk remembered the words Sophronia had cast into the god's teeth during her confrontation with the Seeker at the north end of Lake Benny. Impotent, she had called him, and emasculate. He preferred not to speculate on the means the younger gods may have used to mutilate their older relative. There was a pale greenish nimbus emanating from the idol, a glow much like that that had come from the face of the Seeker. There was a ceremony of some sort taking place on the circular black floor far below in the sickly green glow coming from the altar. Sparhawk's mind recoiled from the notion of calling that ceremony a religious rite. The celebrants cavorted naked before the idol. Sparhawk was not some unworldly cloistered monk. He was acquainted with the world, but the levels of perversion being demonstrated in that rite turned his stomach. The orgy that had so engrossed the primitive Aline Zamox back in the mountains had been childlike, almost pure by comparison. These celebrants appeared to be attempting to duplicate the perversions of non-humans, and their fixed stares and galvanic movements clearly showed that they would continue the ceremony until they died from sheer excess. The lower tiers of that huge stair-stepped basin were packed with green-robed figures who raised a groaning, discordant chant, an empty sound, devoid of any thought or emotion. Then a slight movement caught Sparhawk's eye, and he looked quickly toward his right. A group of people were gathered on the top terrace 100 yards or more away, beneath the leprous white statue of something that must have been dredged from the depths of madness. One of the figures had white hair. Sparhawk twisted around and signaled to Euloth to pull him back up again. "Well?" Carlton asked him. "It's all one big room," Sparhawk murmured. "The idol is over on the far side, and there are wide terraces leading down to a floor in the middle."
"What's the noise?" Finian asked.
"They're holding some sort of rite. I think that chant's a part of it."
"I'm not concerned about their religion," Euloth rumbled. "Are there any soldiers?"
Sparhawk shook his head.
"That's helpful. Anything else?"
"Yes. I need some magic, Sophronia. Martell and the others are gathered on the top terrace. They're about 100 paces off to the right. We need to know what they're saying. Are we close enough for your spell to work?"
She nodded. "Let's move back away from the stairs," she suggested. "The spell makes a certain amount of light, and we don't want anyone to know that we're here just yet."
They retreated back along the dusty pathway, and Sophronia took Sir Bavier's polished shield from Bayret.
"This should do it," she said.
She quickly cast the spell and released it. The knights gathered around the suddenly glowing shield, peering at the hazy figures appearing on its mirror-like surface. The voices coming from the image were tinny-sounding, but they were intelligible.
"Thine assurances to me that my gold would buy thee that throne from which thou couldst further our purposes were hollow, Aeneas,"
Otha was saying in that gurgling rumble.
"It was Sparhawk again, your majesty,"
Aeneas tried to excuse himself in an almost groveling tone.
"He disrupted things, as we had feared he would."
"Sparhawk,"
Otha spat out a foul oath, and slammed his fist down on the arm of his throne-like litter.
The man's existence doth canker my soul. His very name doth cause me pain. Thou wert to keep him away from Kyrillos, Martell. Why didst thou fail me and my god?
I didn't really fail, Your Majesty, Martell replied calmly, and neither did Annius, for that matter. Putting his grace on the arch-prelate's throne was only a means to an end, and we've achieved that end. Beliom is under this very roof. The scheme to elevate Annius so that he could force the Alenes to surrender the jewel to us was filled with uncertainties. This has been much faster and much more direct. Results are what Azash wants, Your Majesty, not the success or failure of any of the interim steps.
Otha grunted.
Perhaps, he conceded. But Beliom hath not been passively delivered into the possession of our god. It doth still lie in the hands of this Sparhawk. Ye have put armies in his path, and he doth easily overwhelm them. Our master hath sent servants more horrible than death itself to slay him, and he lives yet.
Sparhawk's only a man, after all, Lycaeus said in his whining voice. His luck can't last forever.
Otha threw a look at Lycaeus that quite plainly spoke of death. Arissa put her arm protectively around her son's shoulders, and looked as if she were about to come to his defense, but Annius shook his head warningly.
Thou hast defiled thyself by acknowledging this bastard of thine, Annius,
Otha declared in a tone of towering contempt. He paused, looking at them.
Can none of ye understand?
He suddenly roared.
This Sparhawk is Anakar, the unknown. The destinies of all men are clearly visible. All men, save Anakar. Anakar moves outside of destiny. Even the gods fear him. He and Beliom are linked in some way beyond the comprehension of the men or the gods of this world, and the goddess Aphrael serves them. We do not know their purpose. All that doth save us from them lies in the fact that Beliom's submission to Sparhawk is reluctant. Should it ever yield to him willingly, he will be a god.
But he's not a god yet, Your Majesty. Martell smiled. He's trapped in that maze, and he'll never leave his companions behind to assault us alone. Sparhawk's predictable. That's why Azash accepted Annius and me. We know Sparhawk, and we know what he'll do.
And didst thou know that he would succeed as he hath?
Otha sneered.
Didst thou know that his coming here would threaten our very existence and the existence of our god?
Martell looked at the obscenely cavorting figures on the floor below. How long will that continue? He asked. We need some guidance from Azash at this point, and we can't get his attention while that's going on.
The rite is nearly complete, Otha told him. The celebrants are beyond exhaustion. They will die soon.
Good. Then we'll be able to speak with our master. He's also in danger.
Martell!
Otha said sharply, his voice filled with alarm.
Sparhawk hath broken out of the maze. He hath reached the pathway to the temple. Summon men to stop him,
Martell barked.
I have, but they are far behind him. He will reach us before they can hinder him. We must rouse Azash,
Annius cried in a shrill voice.
To interrupt this rite is death,
Otha declared. Martell straightened and took his ornate helmet out from under his arm. Then it's up to me, I guess, he said bleakly. Sparhawk raised his head. From far off in the direction of the palace he could hear the sound of battering rams pounding on a stone wall. That's enough, he said to Sophronia. We have to move. Otha's called soldiers to break down that wall that leads to the stairs near the palace. I hope Bavier and Talon are out of sight, Calton said. They are, Sparhawk told him. Bavier knows what he's doing. We're going to have to go down into the temple. This attic, or whatever you want to call it, is too open.
If we try to fight here, we'll have soldiers coming at us from all sides. He looked at Sophronia. Is there some way we can block those stairs behind us? He asked her. Her eyes narrowed.
I think so, she replied.
You sound a bit dubious.
No, not really. I can block the stairway easily enough, but I can't be sure whether Otha knows the counterspell.
He won't know that you've blocked it until his soldiers arrive and can't come down the stairs, will he? Tinian asked her.
No, actually he won't.
Very good, Tinian. Do we just run around that top terrace and confront the idol? Calton asked.
We can't, Sophronia told him. Oath is a magician, you remember. He'd be hurling spells at our backs every step of the way. We'll have to confront him directly.
And Martell as well, Sparhawk added. Now then, Otha doesn't dare to interrupt Azash while that rite's going on. We can take advantage of that. All we'll have to worry about is Otha himself. Can we deal with him, Sophronia?
She nodded. Otha's not brave, she replied. If we threaten him, he'll use his power to shield himself from us. He'll count on the soldiers coming from the palace to deal with us.
We'll try it, Sparhawk said. Are we all ready, then?
They nodded.
Just be careful, he told them, and I don't want any interference when I go after Martell. All right. Let's go. They went to the head of the stairs, paused a moment, then drew in a collective deep breath and marched down with drawn weapons. Ah, there you are, old boy, Sparhawk drawled to Martell, deliberately imitating the white-haired renegade's nonchalance. I've been looking all over for you. I was right here, Sparhawk, Martell replied, drawing his sword. So I see. I must have gotten turned around somehow. I hope I didn't keep you waiting. Not at all. Splendid. I hate being tardy. He looked them over. Good. I see that we're all here. He looked a bit more closely at the primate of Cimera. Really, Aeneas, you should try to get more sun. You're as white as a sheet.
Oh, before you two get started, Martell, Calton said, I brought you a present, a little memento of our visit. I'm sure you'll cherish it always. He bent slightly and gave the cloak he was carrying a little flip, holding one edge firmly in his gauntleted fist. The cloak unfurled on the onyx floor. Ada's head rolled out and bounced across to stop at Martell's feet where it lay staring up at him. How very kind of you, Sir Calton, Martell said from between clenched teeth. Seemingly indifferent, he kicked the head off to one side. I'm sure that obtaining this gift for me cost you a great deal. Sparhawk's fist tightened about his sword hilt, and his brain seethed with hatred. It cost me Curic, Martell, he said in a flat voice, and now it's time to settle accounts. Martell's eyes widened briefly.
Curic,
he said in a stunned voice. I didn't expect that. I'm truly sorry, Sparhawk. I liked him. If you ever get back to Deimos, give Asladi my sincerest apologies.
I don't think so, Martell. I won't insult Asladi by mentioning your name to her. Shall we get on with this?
Sparhawk began to move forward, his shield braced and his sword point moving slowly back and forth like the head of a snake. Calton and the others grounded their weapons and stood watching grimly. A gentleman to the end, I see, Martell said, putting on his helmet and moving away from Otha's litter to give himself fighting room. Your good manners and your sense of fair play will be the death of you yet, Sparhawk. You had the advantage. You should have used it.
I'm not going to need it, Martell. You still have a moment or two for repentance. I'd advise you to use the time well.
Martell smiled thinly.
I don't think so, Sparhawk, he said. I made my choice. I won't demean myself by changing it now. He clapped down his visor.
They struck simultaneously, their swords ringing on each other's shields. They had trained together under Curic's instruction as boys, so there was no possibility of some trick or feint giving either of them an opening.
They were so evenly matched that there was no way to predict the outcome of this duel that had been a decade and more in the preparation. Their first strokes were tentative as they carefully felt each other out, looking for alterations in technique or changes in their relative strength. To the untrained onlooker, their hammering at each other might have seemed frenzied and without thought. But that was not the case. Neither of them was so enraged as to overextend himself and leave himself open. Great dents appeared in their shields, and showers of sparks cascaded down over them each time their sword edges clashed against each other. Back and forth they struggled, moving slowly away from the spot where Otha's jeweled litter sat, and where Aeneas, Arissa, and Lycaeus stood watching, wide-eyed and breathless. That, too, was a part of Sparhawk's strategy. He needed to draw Martell away from Otha, so that Calton and the others could menace the bloated emperor. To gain that end, he retreated a few paces now and then when it was not actually necessary, drawing Martell step by step away from his friends.
"You must be getting old, Sparhawk," Martell panted, hammering at his former brother's shield. "No more than you are, Martell."
Sparhawk delivered a massive blow that staggered his opponent.
Calton, Ulith, and Tinian, followed by Beirut, who swung Sir Bavior's hideous Lochaber, fanned out to advance on Otha and Aeneas. Slug-like Otha waved one arm, and a shimmering barrier appeared around his litter and Martell's companions.
Sparhawk felt the faintest of tingles along the back of his neck, and he knew that Sophronia was weaving the spell that would block the stairs. He rushed at Martell, swinging his sword as rapidly as he could to so distract the white-haired man that he would not feel that faint, familiar sensation that always accompanied the release of a friend's spell. Sophronia had trained Martell, and he would know her touch. The fight raged on. Sparhawk was panting and sweating now, and his sword arm ached with weariness. He stepped back, lowering his sword slightly in the traditional wordless suggestion that they pause for long enough to get their breath. That suggestion was never considered a sign of weakness. Martell also lowered his sword in agreement.
"Almost like old times, Sparhawk," he panted, pushing open his visor.
"Close," Sparhawk agreed.
"You've picked up some new tricks, I see."
He also opened his visor.
"I spent too much time in Lamerkand. Lamerk's swordsmanship is clumsy, though. Your technique seems to be a little renderish."
10 years of exile there. Sparhawk shrugged, breathing deeply as he tried to regain his wind.
"Vanion would skin the both of us if he saw us flailing at each other this way."
"He probably would. Vanion's a perfectionist."
"That's God's own truth."
They stood panting and staring intently into each other's eyes, watching for that minuscule narrowing that would preface a surprise blow. Sparhawk could feel the ache slowly draining from his right shoulder.
"Are you ready?" he asked finally. "Any time you are."
They clanged their visors shut again and resumed the fight.
Martell launched a complicated and extended series of sword strokes. The series was familiar since it was one of the oldest, and its conclusion was inevitable. Sparhawk moved his shield and his sword in the prescribed defense, but he had known as soon as Martell swung the first stroke that he was going to receive a near stunning blow to the head. Curic, however, had devised a modification to the Pantheon helmet not long after Martell's expulsion from the Order, and when the renegade swung his heavy blow at Sparhawk's head, Sparhawk ducked his chin slightly to take the stroke full on the crest of his helmet, a crest that was now heavily reinforced. His ears rang, nonetheless, and his knees buckled slightly. He was, however, able to parry the follow-up stroke that might well have disabled him. Martell's reactions seemed somehow slower than Sparhawk remembered them as having been. His own blows, he conceded, probably no longer had the crisp snap of youth. They were both older, and an extended duel with a man of equal strength and skill ages one rapidly. Then he suddenly understood. And the action came simultaneously with understanding. He unleashed a series of overhand strokes at Martell's head, and the renegade was forced to protect himself with both sword and shield. Then Sparhawk followed that flurry to the head with the traditional body thrust. Martell knew it was coming, of course, but he simply could not move his shield rapidly enough to protect himself. The point of Sparhawk's sword crunched into his armor low on the right side of his chest and drove deeply into his body.
Martell stiffened, then coughed a great spray of blood out through the slots of his visor. He tried weakly to keep his shield and sword up, but his hands were trembling violently. His legs began to shake. His sword fell from his hand and his shield dropped to his side. He coughed again, a wet, tearing sound. Blood poured from his visor once more, and he slowly collapsed in a heap, face down. "Finish it, Sparhawk," he gasped. Sparhawk pushed him over onto his back with one foot. He raised his sword, then lowered it again. He knelt beside the dying man. "There's no need," he said quietly, opening Martell's visor. "How did you manage that?" Martell asked. "It's that new armor of yours. It's too heavy. You got tired and started to slow down." "There's a certain justice there," Martell said, trying to breathe shallowly so that the blood rapidly filling his lungs would not choke him again. "Killed by my own vanity." "That's probably what kills us all, eventually." "It was a good fight, though." "Yes, it was. And we finally found out which of us is the best. Perhaps it's the time for truth. I never had any real doubts, you know." "I did." Sparhawk knelt quietly, listening to Martell's breathing growing shallower and shallower. "Lacus died, you know," he said quietly. "And Olvan."
"Lacus and Olvan?
I didn't know that."
"Was I in any way responsible?"
"No, it was something else."
"That's some small comfort, anyway. Could you call Sifrania for me, Sparhawk? I'd like to say goodbye to her."
Sparhawk raised his arm and motioned to the woman who had trained them both. Her eyes were full of tears as she knelt across Martell's body from Sparhawk.
"Yes, dear one," she said to the dying man.
"You always said I'd come to a bad end, little mother," Martell said wryly, his voice no more than a whisper now. "But you were wrong. This isn't so bad at all. It's almost like a formal deathbed. I get to depart in the presence of the only two people I've ever really loved. Will you bless me, little mother?"
She put her hands to his face and spoke gently in Styric. Then, weeping, she bent and kissed his pallid forehead. When she raised her face again, he was dead. Chapter 30 Sparhawk rose to his feet and helped Sifrania to stand.
"Are you all right, dear one?" she whispered.
"I'm well enough."
Sparhawk stared hard at Otha.
"Congratulations, Sir Knight,"
Otha rumbled ironically, his sweaty head gleaming in the light of the fires.
"And I thank thee. Long have I pondered the problem of Martell. He sought methinks to rise above himself. And his usefulness to me ended when thou and thy companions brought Beliom to me. I am well rid of him."
"Call it a farewell gift, Otha."
"Oh? Art thou leaving?"
"No. But you are."
Otha laughed. It was a revolting sound.
"He's afraid, Sparhawk," Sifrania whispered. "He's not sure that you can't break through his shield."
"Can I?"
"I'm not sure either. He's very vulnerable now, though, because Azash is totally distracted by that rite."
"That's a place to start, then."
Sparhawk drew in a deep breath and started toward the bloated Emperor of Zamok. Otha flinched back and made a quick signal to the half-naked brutes around him. The bearers picked up the litter upon which he grossly sprawled and started toward the terraces leading down toward the onyx floor, where the naked celebrants, twitching and blank-faced with exhaustion, continued their obscene rite. Annia, Sarissa, and Lycaeus went with him, their eyes fearful as they stayed as close to his litter as possible to remain within the questionable safety of the glowing nimbus of his protective shield. When the litter reached the onyx floor, Otha shouted to the green-robed priests, and they rushed forward, their faces alight with mindless devotion as they drew weapons from beneath their vestments.
from behind them. Sparhawk heard a sudden cry of frustrated chagrin. The soldiers rushing to the aid of their emperor had just encountered Sophrenia's barrier.
"Will it hold?" he asked her.
"It will unless one of those soldiers is stronger than I am."
"Not too likely."
"That leaves only the priests, then." He looked at his friends.
"All right, gentlemen," he said to them. "Let's form up around Sophrenia and clear a path through here."
The priests of Azash wore no armor, and the way they handled their weapons showed little evidence of skill. They were styric for the most part, and the sudden appearance of hostile church knights in the holy center of their religion had startled them and filled them with dismay. Sparhawk remembered something Sophrenia had once said. Styrics, she had told him, do not react well when they are surprised. The unexpected tends to confound them. He could feel a faint prickling sensation as he and his armored friends started down the stair-step terraces, a prickling that told him that some few of the priests, at least, were attempting to put some form of spell together. He roared in a lean war cry, a harsh bellow filled with a lust for blood and violence. The prickling evaporated.
"Lots of noise, gentlemen," he shouted to his friends. "Keep them off balance so they can't use magic."
The church knights rushed down the black terraces, bellowing war cries and brandishing their weapons. The priests recoiled, and then the knights were on them. Beirut pushed past Sparhawk, his eyes alight with enthusiasm, and Sir Bavier's Lochaber at the ready.
"Save your strength, Sparhawk,"
he said gruffly, trying to make his voice deeper, more roughly masculine. He stepped purposefully in front of the startled Sparhawk, and strode into the green-robed ranks facing them, swinging the Lochaber like a scythe. Sparhawk reached out to pull him back, but Sophrenia laid her hand on his wrist. "No, Sparhawk," she said. "This is important to him, and he's in no particular danger." Otha had reached the polished altar in front of the idol, and was staring at the carnage below in open-mouthed fright. Then he drew himself up.
"Approach then, Sparhawk," he blustered. "My god grows impatient."
"I doubt that, Otha," Sparhawk called back. "Azash wants Belion, but he doesn't want me to deliver it to him, because he doesn't know what I'm going to do with it."
"Very good, Sparhawk," Sophrenia murmured. "Use your advantage. Azash will sense Otha's uncertainty, and he'll feel the same way."
The temple echoed with the noise of blows, shrieks, and groans, as Sparhawk's friends systematically slaughtered the green-robed priests. They chopped their way through the tightly packed ranks until they reached the foot of the first terrace below the altar. In spite of everything, Sparhawk felt tightly exultant. He had not expected to make it this far, and his unexpected survival filled him with a sense of euphoric invincibility.
"Well, Otha," he said, looking up those stair-step terraces at the bloated emperor,
"why don't you awaken Azash? Let's find out if the elder gods know how to die as well as men do."
Otha gaped at him, then scrambled from his litter and crumpled to the floor as his puny legs refused to support him.
"Kneel," he half screamed at Aeneas. "Kneel and pray to our god for deliverance."
The notion that his soldiers could not enter the temple obviously frightened Otha considerably.
"Calton," Sparhawk called to his friend, "finish up with the priests and then make sure that those soldiers don't break through and rush us from behind."
"That's not necessary, Sparhawk," Sophrenia said.
"I know, but it should keep them back out of harm's way." He drew in a deep breath. "Here we go, then." He shook off his gauntlets, tucked his sword blade under his arm, and took the steel mesh pouch from his belt. He unwrapped the wire that bound the pouch shut and shook Belion out into his hand. The jewel seemed very hot, and light, wavering like heat lightning on a summer's night, seethed among its petals.
"Blue Rose," he said sharply, "you must do as I command."
Otha, half-kneeling, half-squatting, was babbling a prayer to his god, a prayer made almost unintelligible by his fright. Aeneas, Lycaeus, and Orissa also knelt, and they stared up at the hideous face of the idol looming above them. Their eyes were filled with horror as they more closely beheld the reality of that god they had so willingly chosen to follow.
"Come, Azash," Otha pleaded. "Awaken. Hear the prayer of thy servants."
The idol's deep-sunk eyes had been closed, but now they slowly opened, and that greenish fire blazed from them. Sparhawk felt wave upon wave of malevolence blazing at him from those baleful eyes, and he stood, stunned into near insensibility by the titanic presence of a god. The idol was moving. A kind of undulation rippled down its body, and the tentacle arms sinuously reached forth, reaching toward the glowing stone in Sparhawk's hand, yearning toward the one thing in all the world that offered restoration and freedom.
No!
Sparhawk's voice was a harsh rasp. He raised his sword above the Beliom.
I'll destroy it, he threatened, and you along with it.
The idol seemed to recoil, and its eyes were suddenly filled with amazed shock.
Why hast thou brought this ignorant savage into my presence, Sifrenia?
The voice was hollow, and it echoed throughout the temple and in Sparhawk's mind as well. Sparhawk knew that the mind of Azash could obliterate him in the space between two heartbeats, but for some reason Azash seemed afraid to bring his power to bear upon the rash man who stood menacing the sapphire rose with drawn sword.
I do but obey my destiny, Azash, Sifrenia replied calmly. I was born to bring Sparhawk to this place to face thee.
But what of the destiny of this Sparhawk? Dost thou know what he is destined to do?
There was a kind of desperation in the voice of Azash.
No man or god knoweth that, Azash, she reminded him. Sparhawk is Anaka, and all the gods have known and feared that one day Anaka would come, and would move through this world committed to ends that none may perceive. I am the servant of his destiny, whatever it may be, and I have brought him here that he may bring those ends to fruition.
The idol seemed to tense itself, and then an irresistible command lashed out, overpowering and insistent, and the command was not directed at Sparhawk. Sifrenia gasped and seemed almost to wilt like a flower before the first blast of winter. Sparhawk could actually feel her resolve fading. She wavered as the force of the mind of Azash peeled away her defenses. He tensed his arm and raised his sword higher. If Sifrenia were to fall, they were lost, and he could not know if there would be time to deliver the last fatal stroke after her collapse. He drew the image of Alana's face in his mind, and gripped his sword hilt even more tightly. The sound was not audible to anyone else. He knew that. It was in his mind only. Only he could hear it. It was the insistent, commanding sound of shepherd's pipes, and there was a very strong overtone of irritation to it. Aphrael, he called out in sudden relief. A small firefly spark appeared in front of his face.
Well, finally, Plute's voice snapped angrily. What took you so long, Sparhawk? Don't you know that you have to call me?
No, I didn't know that. Help Sifrenia! There was no touch, no movement, no sound, but Sifrenia straightened, brushing at her brow with lightly touching fingers, as the idol's eyes burned and fixed themselves on the firefly spark.
My daughter, the voice of Azash said, wilt thou cast thy lot with these mortals?
I am no daughter of thine, Azash, Flute's voice was crisp. I willed myself into existence, as did my brothers and sisters when thou and thy kindred did tear at the fabric of reality with thy childish contention. I am thy daughter only through thy fault. Hadst thou and thy kindred turned ye aside from that reckless course that would have destroyed all, there would have been no need for me and mine.
I will have Beliom!
The hollow voice was the thunder and the earthquake tearing at the very foundations of the earth.
Thou shalt not!
Flute's voice was flatly contradictory. It was to deny thee and thy kind possession of Beliom that I and my kind came into existence. Beliom is not of this place, and it must not be held here in bondage to thee or to me or to the troll gods or any other gods of this world.
I will have it!
The voice of Azash rose to a scream.
No! Anaka will destroy it first, and in its destruction shalt thou perish.
The idol seemed to flinch.
How darest thou?
It gasped.
How darest thou even speak such horror? In the death of one of us lieth the seeds of the deaths of us all.
So be it, then.
Afrael's tone was indifferent. Then her light little voice took on a cruel note.
Direct thy fury at me, Azash, and not at my children. For it was I who used the power of the rings to emasculate thee, and to confine thee forever in that idol of mud.
It was thou?
The terrible voice seemed stunned.
It was I. Thy power is so abated by thine emasculation that thou canst not escape thy confinement. Thou wilt not have Beliom, impotent godling, and thus shalt thou be forever imprisoned. Thou shalt remain unmanned and confined until the farthest star burns down to ashes.
She paused, and when she spoke again it was in the tone of one slowly twisting a knife buried in the body of another.
It was thine absurd and transparent proposal that all the gods of Styricum unite to seize Beliom from the troll gods for the good of all that gave me the opportunity to mutilate and confine thee, Azash. Thou hast none to blame but thyself for what hath befallen thee. And now Anakah hath brought Beliom and the rings, and even the troll gods locked within the jewel, here to confront thee. I call upon thee to submit to the power of the Sapphire Rose, or to perish.
There was a howl of inhuman frustration, but the idol made no move. Otha, however, his eyes filled with panic, began to mutter a desperate spell. Then he hurled it forth, and the hideous statues encircling the interior of the vast temple began to shimmer, changing from marble white to greens and blues and bloody reds, and the babble of their inhuman voices filled the dome. Sophrania spoke two words in Styric, her voice calm. She gestured, and the statues froze again, congealing back into pallid marble. Otha howled, then began to speak again, so frustrated and enraged that he did not even speak in Styric, but in his native Eline.
Listen to me, Sparhawk.
Flute's musical voice was very soft. But Otha...
He's only babbling. My sister can deal with him. Pay attention. The time will come very soon when you'll have to act. I'll tell you when. Climb these stairs to the idol and keep your sword poised over Beliom. If Azash or Otha or anything else tries to keep you from reaching the idol, smash the Beliom. If all goes well and you reach the idol, touch Beliom to that place that looks burned and scarred.
Will that destroy Azash?
Of course not. The idol that's sitting there is only an encasement. The real idol is inside that big one. Beliom will shatter the big idol and you'll be able to see Azash himself. The real idol is quite small, and it's made of dried mud. As soon as you can see it, drop your sword and hold Beliom in both hands. Then use these exact words. Blue Rose, I am Sparhawk from Elenia. By the power of these rings I command Blue Rose to return this image to the earth from which it came. Then touch Beliom to the idol.
What happens then?
I'm not sure.
Afrael!
Sparhawk said it in a tone of startled protest.
Beliom's destiny is even more obscure than yours, and I can't tell from one minute to the next what you're going to do.
Will it destroy Azash?
Oh, yes. And quite possibly the rest of the world as well. Beliom wants to be free of this world, and this might just be the chance it's been waiting for.
Sparhawk swallowed very hard.
It's a gamble,
she conceded in an offhand way.
But we never know which way the dice are going to turn up until we roll them, do we?
The temple suddenly went totally dark, as Sophrania and Otha continued their struggle, and for a breathless moment it seemed as if that darkness might be eternal, so intense was it. Then the light gradually returned. The fires in those great iron braziers renewed themselves, and gradually the flames rose again. As the light returned, Sparhawk found that he was looking at Aeneas. The primate of Cimmera's emaciated face was a ghastly white, and all thought had vanished from his eyes. Blinded by his obsessive ambition, Aeneas had never looked fully at the horror to which he had pledged his soul in his pursuit of the archprelate's throne. Now at last he obviously perceived it, and now just as obviously, it was too late.
He stared at Sparhawk, his eyes pleading mutely for something, anything, that would save him from the pit that had opened before his feet. Lycaeus was blubbering, gibbering in terror, and Arissa held him in her arms, clinging to him, actually, and her face was no less filled with horror than that of Aeneas. The temple filled with noise and light, shattering sound and boiling smoke, as Otha and Sophronia continued to grapple.
"It's time, Sparhawk." Flute's voice was very calm. Sparhawk braced himself and started forward, his sword held threateningly over the sapphire rose, which seemed almost to cringe beneath that heavy steel blade.
"Sparhawk," the little voice was almost wistful, "I love you."
The next sound he heard was not one of love, however. It was a snarling howl in the language of the trolls. It was more than one voice, and it came from Beliom itself. Sparhawk reeled as the hatred of the troll gods lashed at him. The pain was unendurable. He burned and froze at the same time, and his bones heaved and surged within his flesh. "Blue Rose," he gasped, faltering, almost falling. "Command the troll gods to be silent. Blue Rose will do it now." The agony continued, and the trollish howling intensified. "Then die, Blue Rose." Sparhawk raised his sword. The howling broke off abruptly and the pain stopped. Sparhawk crossed the first onyx terrace and stepped up onto the next.
"Do not do this, Sparhawk."
The voice was in his mind.
"Afrael is a spiteful child. She leads thee to thy doom."
"I was wondering how long it was going to be, Azash," Sparhawk said in a shaking voice as he crossed the second terrace. "Why did you not speak to me before?" The voice that had spoken in his mind was silent.
"Were you afraid, Azash?" he asked. "Were you afraid that something you said might change that destiny that you cannot see?"
He stepped up onto the third terrace.
"Do not do this, Sparhawk,"
the voice was pleading now.
"I can give thee the world."
"No, thank you."
"I can give thee immortality."
"I'm not interested. Men are used to the idea of dying. It's only the gods who find the thought so frightening." He crossed the third terrace.
"I will destroy thy comrades if thou dost persist."
"All men die sooner or later." Sparhawk tried to sound convincingly indifferent. He stepped up onto the fourth terrace. He felt as if he were suddenly trying to wade through solid rock. Azash did not dare attack him directly, since that might trigger the fatal stroke that would destroy them all. Then, Sparhawk saw his one absolute advantage. Not only could the gods not see his destiny, they could not see his thoughts either. Azash could not know when the decision to strike would come. Azash could not feel him make that decision, and so he could not stop the sword stroke. He decided to play on that advantage. Still locked in place, he sighed. "Oh, well, if that's the way you want it." He raised his sword again. "No!" The cry came not only from Azash, but from the snarling troll gods as well. Sparhawk crossed the fourth terrace. He was sweating profusely. He could hide his thoughts from the gods, but not from himself. "Now, Blue Rose," he said quietly to Beliom as he stepped up onto the fifth terrace, "I am going to do this. You and Quaj and Gnomb and the others will aid me, or you will perish. A god must die here. One god or many. If you aid me, it will only be the one. If you do not, it will be the many."
"Sparhawk!"
Apriel's voice was shocked.
"Don't interfere."
There was a momentary hesitation.
"Can I help?"
she whispered in a little girl voice. He thought only for an instant.
"All right, but this isn't the time for games, and don't startle me. My arms set like a coiled spring."
The firefly spark began to expand, softening from intensity to a glow, and Afrael emerged from that glow, her shepherd's pipes held to her lips. As always, her little feet were grass-stained. Her face was somber as she lowered the pipes.
"Go ahead and smash it, Sparhawk," she said sadly. "They'll never listen to you."
She sighed.
"I grow weary of unending life anyway. Smash the stone and have done with it.
The Belion went absolutely dark, and Sparhawk felt it shudder violently in his hand. Then its blue glow returned, soft and submissive.
They'll help now, Sparhawk,
Afriel told him.
You lied to them, he accused. No, I lied to you. I wasn't talking to them.
He could not help but laugh.
He crossed the fifth terrace. The idol was much closer now, and it loomed large in his sight. He could also see Otha sweating and straining as he and Sophronia engaged in that duel that Sparhawk knew, could he but see it, was far more titanic than the one he had fought with Martell. He could see more clearly now the stark terror in the face of Aeneas and the near collapse of Arissa and her son. Sparhawk could sense the gigantic presence of the troll gods. They seemed so overpoweringly real that he could almost see their gigantic, hideous forms hovering protectively just behind him. He stepped up onto the sixth terrace. Three more to go. Idly, he wondered if the number nine had some significance in the twisted minds of the worshippers of Azash. The god of the Zamoks threw everything to the winds at that point. He saw death inexorably climbing the stairs toward him, and he began to unleash everything in his power in a desperate effort to ward off the black-armored messenger carrying his glowing blue death to him. Fire burst from beneath Sparhawk's feet, but before he even felt its heat, it was quenched in ice. A monstrous form lunged at him, springing from nothingness, but an even more intense fire than that the ice had just vanquished consumed it. The troll gods, unwilling certainly, but left without a choice by Sparhawk's adamantine ultimatum, were aiding him now, beating aside the defenses of Azash to clear his path. Azash began to shriek as Sparhawk stepped up onto the seventh terrace. A rush was now feasible, but Sparhawk decided against it. He did not want to be panting and shaking from exertion when the climactic moment arrived. He continued his steady, inexorable pace, crossing the seventh terrace, as Azash unleashed horrors beyond imagining at him, horrors instantly quenched by the troll gods or even by Belium itself. He drew in a deep breath and stepped up onto the eighth terrace. Then he was surrounded by gold. Coins and ingots and lumps the size of a man's head. A cascade of bright jewels spilled out of nothing to run down over the gold like a river of blue and green and red, a rainbow-hued waterfall of wealth beyond imagining. Then the wealth began to diminish, great chunks of it vanishing to the gross sounds of eating. Thank you, Gnomb, Sparhawk murmured to the troll god of feeding. A houri of heart-stopping loveliness beckoned to Sparhawk seductively, but was immediately assaulted by a lustful troll. Sparhawk did not know the name of the troll god of mating, so he did not know whom to thank. He pushed on to step up onto the ninth and last terrace.
Thou canst not!
Azash shrieked. Sparhawk did not reply, as he marched grimly toward the idol with Belium still in one fist and his menacing sword in the other. Lightning flashed around him, but each bolt was absorbed by the growing sapphire aura with which Belium protected him. Otha had abandoned his fruitless duel with Sophronia and crawled sobbing in fright toward the right side of the altar. Aeneas had collapsed on the left side of that same narrow onyx slab, and Arissa and Lycaeus, clinging to each other, wailed. Sparhawk reached the narrow altar. "Wish me luck," he whispered to the child goddess.
"Of course, father," she replied.
Azash shrank back as Belium's glow intensified, and the idol's burning eyes bulged with terror. Sparhawk saw that an immortal, suddenly faced with the possibility of his own death, is peculiarly defenseless. The idea alone erased all other thought, and Azash could only react at the simplest, most childish level. He lashed out, blindly hurling elemental fire at the black-armored Pandion, threatening his very existence. The shock was enormous as that incandescent green flame struck the equally brilliant blue flame of Belium. The blue wavered, then solidified. The green shrank back, then pushed again at Sparhawk. And there they locked, Belium and Azash, each exerting irresistible force to protect its very existence. Neither of them would, or could, relent.
Sparhawk had the unpleasant conviction that he might very well stand in this one place for all eternity, with the jewel half extended as Azash and Beliom remained locked in their struggle. It came from behind him, spinning and whirring through the air with a sound almost like bird wings. It passed over his head and clanged against the idol's stone chest, exploding forth a great shower of sparks. It was Bavior's hook-pointed Lochaber axe. Beirut, unthinking perhaps, had thrown the Lochaber at the idol, a foolish gesture of puny defiance. But it worked. The idol flinched involuntarily from something that could not possibly hurt it, and its force, its fire, momentarily vanished. Sparhawk lunged forward with Beliom clutched in his left hand, thrusting it like a spear point at the burn scar low on the idol's belly. His hand went numb in the violent shock of contact. The sound was deafening. Sparhawk was sure that it shook the entire world. He bent his head and locked his muscles, pushing Beliom harder and harder against the shiny scar of Azash's emasculation. The god shrieked in agony.
"Ye have failed me!"
he howled, and writhing tentacle arms whipped out from either side of the idol's body to seize Otha and Aeneas.
"Oh, my god!"
the primate of Cimera shrieked, not to Azash, but to the god of his childhood.
"Save me! Protect me! Forgive!"
His voice rose to an inarticulate screech as the tentacle tightened about him. There was no finesse in the punishment inflicted upon the Emperor of Zamok and the primate of Cimera. Maddened by pain and fear, and a hunger to lash out at those he considered responsible, Azash reacted like an infuriated child. Other arms lashed out to seize the shrieking pair, and then, with cruel slowness, the undulating arms began to turn in opposite directions, in that motion used by a washerwoman to wring out a dripping rag. Blood and worse spurted out from between the god's eel-like fingers as he inexorably wrung the lives of Otha and Aeneas from their writhing bodies. Sickened, Sparhawk closed his eyes, but he could not close his ears. The shrieking grew worse, rising to strangled squeals at the very upper edge of hearing. Then they fell silent, and there were two sodden thumps as Azash discarded what was left of his servants. Arissa was retching violently over the unrecognizable remains of her lover and the father of her only child, as the vast idol shuddered and cracked, raining chunks of carved rock as it disintegrated. Writhing arms solidified as they broke free and fell to smash into fragments on the floor. The grotesque face slid in pieces from the front of the head. A large piece of rock struck Sparhawk's armored shoulder, and the impact quite nearly jarred Beliom from his hands. With a great cracking noise, the idol broke at the waist, and the vast upper trunk toppled backward to smash into a million pieces on the polished black floor. A stump only remained, a kind of crumbling stone pedestal, upon which sat that crude mud idol that Otha had first seen almost 2,000 years before.
"Thou canst not!"
The voice was the squeal of a small animal, a rabbit maybe, or perhaps a rat.
"I am a god! Thou art nothing! Thou art an insect! Thou art as dirt!"
"Perhaps," Sparhawk said, actually feeling pity for the pathetic little mud figurine. He dropped his sword and clasped Beliom firmly in both hands. "Blue Rose," he said sharply. "I am Sparhawk from Elania. By the power of these rings, I command Blue Rose to return this image to the earth from which it came." He thrust both hands and the sapphire rose forward. "Thou hast hungered for Beliom, Azash," he said. "Have it, then. Have it, and all that it brings thee." Then the Beliom touched the misshapen little idol. "Blue Rose will obey. Now." He clenched himself as he said it, expecting instant obliteration. The entire temple shuddered, and Sparhawk felt a sudden oppressive sense of heaviness bearing down on him, as if the air itself had the weight of tons. The flames of the huge fires sickened, lowering into fitful flickers as if some great weight pressed them down, smothering them. And then the vast dome of the temple exploded upward and outward, hurling the hexagonal blocks of basalt miles away. With a sound that was beyond sound, the fires belched upward, becoming enormous pillars of intensely brilliant flame, columns that shot up through the gaping hole that had been the dome, to illuminate the pregnant bellies of the clouds that had spawned the thunderstorm. Higher and higher those incandescent columns roared, searing the cloud mass above. And still they reared higher, wreathed with lightning as they burned the clouds away, and ascended still into the darkness above, reaching toward the glittering stars. Sparhawk, implacable and unrelenting, held the sapphire rose against the body of Azash, the skin of his wrist crawling as the god's tiny, impotent tentacles clutched at it, as a mortally stricken warrior might clutch at the arm of a foe slowly twisting a sword blade in his vitals. The voice of Azash, elder god of Styricum, was a tiny squeal, a puny wail such as any small creature might make as it died. Then a change came over the little idol. Whatever had made it adhere together was gone, and with a slithering kind of sigh, it came apart and settled into a heap of dust. The great columns of flame slowly subsided, and the air that flooded into the ruined temple from the outside once again had the chill of winter. Sparhawk felt no sense of triumph as he straightened. He looked at the sapphire rose glowing in his hand. He could feel its terror, and he could dimly hear the whimpering of the troll gods locked in its azure heart. Flute had somehow stumbled back down the terraces and wept in Sifrania's arms. "It's over, Blue Rose," Sparhawk said wearily to the Belion. "Rest now." He slipped the jewel back into the pouch and absently twisted the wire to hold it shut. There was the sound of running then, of frantic flight. Princess Arissa and her son fled down the onyx terraces toward the shiny floor below. So great was their fright that neither appeared to be even aware of the other as they stumbled down and down. Lycaeus was younger than his mother and his flight was swifter. He left her behind, leaping, falling, and scrambling back to his feet again as he bolted. Eulyph, his face like stone, was waiting for him at the bottom, with his axe. Lycaeus shrieked once, and then his head flew out in a long, curving arc and landed on the onyx floor with a sickening sound such as a dropped melon might make.
"Lycaeus!"
Arissa shrieked in horror as her son's headless body fell limply at Eulyph's feet. She stood frozen, gaping at the huge, blonde-braided Thalesian, who had begun to mount the onyx terraces toward her, his bloody axe half-raised. Eulyph was not one to leave a job half-finished. Arissa fumbled at the sash about her waist, pulled out a small glass vial, and struggled to pull the stopper free. Eulyph did not slow his pace. The vial was open now, and Arissa lifted her face and drank its contents. Her body instantly stiffened, and she gave a hoarse cry. Then she fell twitching to the floor of the terrace, her face black and her tongue protruding from her mouth.
"Eulyph," Sifrania said to the still advancing Thalesian, "no, it isn't necessary."
"Poison?"
he asked her. She nodded.
"I hate poison,"
he said, stripping the blood off the edge of his axe with his thumb and forefinger. He flung the blood away and then ran a practiced thumb along the edge.
"It's going to take a week to polish out all these nicks,"
he said mournfully, turning and starting back down again, leaving the Princess Arissa sprawled on the terrace above him. Sparhawk retrieved his sword and descended. He felt very, very tired now. He wearily picked up his gauntlets and crossed the littered floor to Beirut, who stood staring at him in awe. "That was a nice throw," he said to the young man, putting his hand on Beirut's armored shoulder. "Thank you, brother." Beirut's smile was like the sun coming up. "Oh, by the way," Sparhawk added, "you'd probably better go find Bavior's axe. He's very fond of it." Barret grinned. Right away, Sparhawk. Sparhawk looked around at the corpse-littered temple. Then up through the shattered dome at the stars twinkling overhead in the cold winter sky. Kurek, he said without thinking. What time do you make it? Then he broke off as a wave of unbearable grief overwhelmed him. He steeled himself. Is everybody all right? He asked his friends, looking around. Then he grunted, not really trusting himself to speak. He drew in a deep breath. Let's get out of here, he said gruffly. They crossed the polished floor and went up the wide terraces to the top. Somehow, in the vast upheaval of the encounter at the altar, all the statues encircling the wall had been shattered. Calton stepped on ahead and looked up the marble stairs. The soldiers seem to have run off, he reported. Sophrenia countered the spell that had blocked the stairs, and they started up.
Sophrenia?
The voice was hardly more than a croak.
She's still alive, Euleth said almost accusingly.
That happens once in a while, Sophrenia said. Sometimes the poison takes a little longer.
Sophrenia, help me. Please help me.
The small Styric woman turned and looked back across the temple at Princess Arissa, who had weakly raised her head to plead for her life. Sophrenia's tone was as cold as death itself.
No, Princess, she replied. I don't think so.
Then she turned again and went on up the stairs with Sparhawk and the rest of them close behind her. Chapter 31 The wind had changed at some time during the night, and it now blew steadily out of the west, bringing snow with it. The violent thunderstorm that had engulfed the city the previous night had unroofed many houses and exploded others. The streets were littered with debris, and with a thin covering of wet snow. Barret had retrieved their horses, and Sparhawk and his friends rode slowly. There was no longer any need for haste. The cart Calton had found in a side street trundled along behind them, with Talon at the reins and Bavier resting in the back with Kurek's covered body. Kurek, Sophrenia assured them as they set out, would remain untouched by the corruption that is the final destiny of all men.
I owe Asladi that much at least, she murmured,
nestling her cheek against Flute's glossy black hair. Sparhawk was a bit surprised to find that in spite of everything he still thought of the child goddess as Flute. She did not look all that much like a goddess at the moment. She clung to Sophrenia, her face tear-streaked, and each time she opened her eyes they were filled with horror and despair. The Zamok soldiers and the few remaining priests of Azash had fled the deserted city, and the slushy streets echoed with a kind of mournful emptiness. Something quite peculiar was happening to Otha's capital. The nearly total destruction of the temple had been completely understandable, of course. The only slightly less severe damage to the adjoining palace was probably to be expected. It was what was happening to the rest of the city that was inexplicable. The inhabitants had not really left the city that long ago, but their houses were collapsing. Not all at once, as might have been expected, given the explosive nature of what had taken place in the temple, but singly, or in groups of two or three. It was somehow as if the decay that overcomes any abandoned city were taking place in the space of hours instead of centuries. The houses sagged, creaked mournfully, and then slowly fell in on themselves. The city walls crumbled, and even the paving stones of the streets heaved up and then settled back, broken and scattered. Their desperate plan had succeeded, but the cost had been beyond what any of them had been prepared to pay. There was no sense of triumph in their success. None of that exultation warriors normally feel in a victory. It was not merely the sorrowful burden of the cart that dampened their mood, however, but something deeper. Bavier was pale from loss of blood, but his face was profoundly troubled. I still don't understand, he confessed.
Sparhawk is Anaka, Sophrenia replied. It's a Styric word that means without destiny. All men are subject to destiny, to fate. All men except Sparhawk. Somehow he moves outside destiny. We've known that he would come, but we didn't know when, or even who he would be.
He's like no other man who's ever lived. He makes his own destiny, and his existence terrifies the gods.
They left the slowly collapsing city of Zamok behind in the thickly swirling snow slanting in from the west, although they could hear the grinding rumble of falling buildings for quite some time as they rode southward along the road leading to the city of Korakech, some 80 leagues to the south. About mid-afternoon, as the snow was beginning to let up, they took shelter for the night in a deserted village. They were all very tired, and the thought of riding even one more mile was deeply repugnant to them. Ulith prepared their supper without even any attempt to resort to his usual subterfuge, and they sought their beds even before the light had begun to fade. Sparhawk awoke suddenly, startled to find that he was in the saddle. They were riding along the brink of a windswept cliff with an angry sea ripping itself to tattered froth on the rocks far below. The sky overhead was threatening, and the wind coming in off the sea had a biting chill. Sophrania rode in the lead, and she held Flute and folded in her arms. The others trailed along behind Sparhawk, their cloaks drawn tightly around them, and wooden expressions of stoic endurance on their faces. They all seemed to be there, Kaltan and Curic, Tinian and Ulith, Beirut and Talon and Bavier. Their horses plodded up the winding, weather-worn trail that followed the edge of the long ascending cliff toward a jutting promontory that thrust a crooked, stony finger out into the sea. At the outermost tip of the rocky promontory stood a gnarled and twisted tree, its streaming branches flailing in the wind. When she reached the tree, Sophrania reined in her horse, and Curic walked forward to lift Flute down. The squire's face was set, and he did not speak to Sparhawk as he passed. It seemed to Sparhawk that something was wrong, terribly wrong, but he could not exactly put his finger on it.
"Very well, then," the little girl said to them. "We're here to finish this, and we don't have all that much time."
"What exactly do you mean by finish this?" Bavier asked her.
"My family has agreed that we must put Belion beyond the reach of men or gods. No one must ever be able to find it or use it again. The others have given me 1 hour, and all of their power, to accomplish this. You may see some things that are impossible. You may have even noticed them already. Don't concern yourselves about them, and don't pester me with questions. We don't have that much time. We were 10 when we set out, and we're the same 10 now. It has to be that way."
"We're going to throw it into the sea, then?" Kaltan asked her. She nodded.
"Hasn't that been tried before?" Ulith asked her. "The Earl of Hade threw King Sarek's crown into Lake Veni, as I recall, and Belium still reemerged."
"The sea is much deeper than Lake Veni," she told him. "The water out there is much deeper than it is anywhere else in the world, and no one knows where this particular shoreline is."
"We do,"
Ulith disagreed.
"Oh? Where is it? On which particular coast of which particular continent?"
She pointed upward at the dense cloud racing overhead.
"And where's the sun? Which way is east and which is west?"
"All you can really say for sure is that you're on a sea coast somewhere. You can tell anyone you like. And then every man who will ever live can start wading in the sea tomorrow, and they'll never find Belion because they'll never know exactly where to look."
"Then you want me to throw it into the sea?" Sparhawk asked her as he dismounted.
"Not quite yet, Sparhawk," she replied. "There's something we have to do first. Would you get that sack I asked you to keep for me, Curic?"
Curic nodded, went back to his gelding, and opened one of his saddlebags. Once again Sparhawk had that strong sense that something was wrong. Curic came back, carrying a small canvas sack. He opened it, and took out a small steel box with a hinged lid and a stout hasp. He held it out to the little girl. She shook her head and held her hands behind her.
"I don't want to touch it," she said. "I just want to look at it to make sure it's right."
She bent forward and examined the box closely. When Curic opened the lid, Sparhawk saw that the interior of the box was lined with gold.
"My brothers did well," she approved. "It's perfect."
"Steel will rust in time, you know," Tinian told her.
"No, dear one," Sophrania told him. "That particular box will never rust."
"What about the troll gods, Sophrania?" Bavier asked.
They've shown us that they can reach out to the minds of men. Won't they be able to call someone and direct him to the place where the box lies hidden? I don't think they'll be happy lying at the bottom of the sea for all eternity.
The troll gods can't reach out to men without the aid of Beliom, she explained, and Beliom's powerless as long as it's locked in steel. It lay helpless in that iron deposit in Thalesia from the time this world was made until the day Gwerig freed it. This may not be entirely foolproof, but it's the best we can do, I think. Set the box down on the ground, Curic, Flute instructed, and open it. Sparhawk, take Beliom out of the pouch and tell it to sleep.
Forever?
I sort of doubt that. This world won't last that long, and once it's gone, Beliom will be free to continue its journey.
Sparhawk took the pouch from his belt and untwisted the wire that held it closed. Then he upended the pouch, and the sapphire rose fell out into his hand. He felt it shudder with a kind of relief as it was freed from its steel confinement.
Blue Rose, he said calmly, I am Sparhawk from Elania. Do you know me?
It glowed a deep, hard blue, neither hostile nor particularly friendly. The muted snarls he seemed to hear deep in his mind, however, told him that the troll gods did not share that neutrality.
The time has come for you to sleep, Blue Rose, Sparhawk said to the jewel. There will be no pain, and when you awaken you will be free.
The jewel shuddered again, and its crystal glitter softened almost as if in gratitude. Sleep now, Blue Rose, he said gently, holding the priceless thing in both hands. Then he placed it in the box and firmly closed the lid. Wordlessly, Curic handed him a small, cunningly wrought lock. Sparhawk nodded and snapped the lock shut on the hasp, noting as he did that the lock had no keyhole. He looked questioningly at the child goddess.
Throw it into the sea, she said, watching him intently.
A vast reluctance came over him. He knew that Beliom, confined as it was, could not be influencing him. The reluctance was his own. For a time, for a few short months, he had possessed something even more eternal than the stars, and he had somehow shared that just by touching it. It was this that made Beliom so infinitely precious. Its beauty, its perfection, had never really had anything to do with it, though he yearned for just one last glimpse of it, one last touch of that soft blue glow on his hands. He knew that once he had cast it away, something very important would be gone from his life, and that he would pass the remainder of his days with a vague sense of loss that might diminish with the passing of years, but would never wholly be gone. He steeled himself, willing the pain of loss to come so that he might teach himself to endure it. Then he leaned back and threw the small steel object as far as he could out over the angry sea. The hurtling steel box arched out over the crashing waves far below, and as it flew, it began to glow, neither red nor blue nor any other color, but rather sheer incandescent white. Far it went, farther than any man could have thrown it, and then like a shooting star it fell in a long, graceful curve into the endlessly rolling sea.
That's it, then? Colton asked. That's all we have to do?
Flute nodded, her eyes filled with tears. You can all go back now, she told them. She sat down beneath the tree and sadly took her pipes out from under her tunic.
Aren't you coming with us? Talon asked her. No, she sighed. I'll stay here for a while.
Then she lifted her pipes and began to play a sad song of regret and loss. They had only ridden a short distance with the sound of the pipes sadly following them, when Sparhawk turned to look back. The tree was still there, of course, but Flute was gone.
She's left us again, he told Sophronia.
Yes, dear one, she sighed.
The wind picked up as they rode down from the promontory, and driven spray began to sting their faces. Sparhawk tried to pull the hood of his cloak forward to shield his face, but it was no use. No matter how hard he tried, the driving spray lashed at his cheeks and nose.
His face was still wet when he suddenly awoke and sat up. He mopped the salt brine away and reached inside his tunic. Belion was not there. He knew that he would have to talk with Sophronia, but there was something he wanted to find out first. He rose and went out of the house where they had set up their camp the previous day. Two doors down the street was the stable where they had put the cart in which Curic lay. Sparhawk gently turned back the blanket and touched his friend's cold face. Curic's face was wet. And when Sparhawk touched his fingertip to his tongue, he could taste the salt brine of the sea. He sat for a long time, his mind reeling back from the immensity of what the child goddess had so casually dismissed as mere impossibilities. The combined might of the younger gods of Styricum, it appeared, could accomplish anything. He decided at last not to even attempt a definition of what had happened. Dream or reality or something in between? What difference did it make? Belion was safe now, and that was all that mattered. They rode south to Korakich and on to Ganadorit, where they turned west toward Kadam, on the Lamut border. Once they reached the lowlands, they began to encounter Zamok's soldiers fleeing to the east. There were no wounded with the soldiers, so there did not appear to have been a battle. There was no sense of accomplishment or even of victory as they rode. The snow turned to rain as they came down out of the highlands, and the mournful dripping of the sky seemed to match their mood. There were no stories or cheerful banter as they rode westward. They were all very tired, and all they really wanted to do was to go home. King Worgen was at Kadam with a huge army. He was not moving, but sat firmly in place, waiting for the weather to break and for the ground to dry out. Sparhawk and the others were led to his headquarters, which, as might have been expected, were in a tavern. "Now there's a real surprise," the half-drunk monarch of Thalesia said to the patriarch Bergsten as Sparhawk and his friends entered. "I thought I'd never see them again. Oh, Sparhawk, come over by the fire. Have something to drink and tell us what you've been up to." Sparhawk removed his helmet and crossed the rush-covered tavern floor. "We went to the city of Zamok, Your Majesty," he reported briefly. "As long as we were there anyway, we killed Otha and Azash. Then we started back." Worgen blinked. "That's right to the point." He laughed. He looked around blearily. "You there!" he bellowed at one of the guards at the door. "Go find Lord Vanion. Tell him that his men have arrived. Did you find some place to lock up your prisoners, Sparhawk?"
"We didn't take any prisoners, Your Majesty."
"Now that's the way to make war. Sarathi's going to be cross with you, though. He really wanted Aeneas to stand trial."
"We'd have brought him, Worgen," Ulith told his king, "but he wasn't very presentable."
"Which one of you killed him?"
"Actually, it was Azash, Your Majesty," Tinian explained. "The Zamok god was very disappointed in Otha and Aeneas, so he did what seemed appropriate."
"How about Martell, and Princess Arissa,
and the bastard Lycaeus?"
"Sparhawk killed Martell," Calton told him. "Ulith chopped Lycaeus' head off, and Arissa took poison."
"Did she die?"
"We assume so. She was doing a fairly good job of it when we left her." Then Vanion came in and went immediately to Sophronia. Their secret, which wasn't really a secret anyway, since everyone with eyes knew how they felt about each other, went out the window as they embraced each other with a kind of fierceness uncharacteristic of either of them. Vanion kissed the cheek of the small woman he had loved for decades.
"I thought I'd lost you," he said in a voice thick with emotion. "You know that I'll never leave you, dear one," she said.
Sparhawk smiled faintly. That dear one that she addressed to them all had rather neatly concealed the real dear ones she directed to Vanion. There was a significant difference in the way she said it, he noticed. Their recounting of what had taken place since they had left Zamok was fairly complete. It was subdued, however, and it omitted a significant number of theological issues. Then Worgen began a rambling and somewhat drink-slurred account of what had happened in Lamarkand and eastern Pelosia during the lengthy interval. The armies of the West, it appeared, had followed the strategy that had been worked out in Kyrillos before the campaign had begun,
and the strategy seemed to have worked quite well.
And then, the tipsy monarch concluded, just when we were ready to get down to some serious fighting, the cowards all turned tail and ran. Why won't anyone stand and fight me?
Worgen's tone was plaintive.
Now I'm going to have to chase them all over the mountains of Zamok to catch them.
Why bother? Sophrania asked him.
Why bother? He exclaimed. To keep them from ever attacking us again, that's why.
Worgen was swaying in his seat, and he clumsily dipped another tankard of ale from the keg at his side. Why waste the lives of your men? She asked. Azash is dead, Otha is dead. The Zamoks will never come again.
Worgen glared at her. Then he pounded his fist on the table. I want to exterminate somebody, he roared. You wouldn't let me wipe out the Rendors. You called me to Kyrelos before I could finish up, but I'll be a cross-eyed troll if I let you steal the Zamoks from me as well.
Then his eyes glazed and he slid slowly under the table and began to snore. Your king has an amazing singleness of purpose, my friend, Tinian said to Yuleth.
Worgen's a simple man, Yuleth shrugged. There isn't room in his head for more than one idea at a time.
I'll go with you to Kyrelos, Sparhawk, Vanion said. I might be able to help you persuade Dolmant to pull Worgen up short. That, of course, was not Vanion's real reason for accompanying them, but Sparhawk chose not to question his friend any more closely. They left Kadam early the following morning. The knights had removed their armor and traveled in mail shirts, tunics, and heavy cloaks. That did not appreciably increase their speed, but it did make them more comfortable. The rain went on day after day, a dreary, foggy drizzle that seemed to wash out all signs of color. They traveled through the sullen tag end of winter, almost never really warm and certainly never wholly dry. They passed through Moterra and rode on to Kadik, where they crossed the river and moved at a canter south toward Kyrelos. Finally, on a rainy afternoon, they reached the top of a hill and looked down at the war-ravaged holy city. Our first step is to find Dolmant, Vanion decided. It's going to take a while for a messenger to get back to Kadam to stop Worgen, and a break in the weather could start to dry out the fields in Zamok. Vanion began to cough, a tearing kind of cough.
Aren't you feeling well? Sparhawk asked him.
I think I've picked up a cold, that's all.
They did not enter Kyrelos as heroes. There were no parades, no fanfares, no cheering throngs throwing flowers. In point of fact, nobody even seemed to recognize them. And the only thing that was thrown was garbage from the windows of the upper floors of the houses they passed. Very little had been done in the way of repairs or reconstruction since Martell's armies had been driven out, and the citizens of Kyrelos existed in squalor among the ruins. They entered the basilica, still muddy and travel-worn, and went directly up to the administrative offices on the second floor.
We have urgent news for the Archprelate, Fenion said to the black-robed churchman who sat at an ornate desk shuffling papers and trying to look important. I'm afraid that's absolutely out of the question, the churchman said, looking disdainfully at Fenion's muddy clothing. Sirathi's meeting with a deputation of Camorian primates at the moment. It's a very important conference, and it mustn't be interrupted by some unimportant military dispatch. Why don't you come back tomorrow?
Vanion's nostrils went white, and he thrust back his cloak to free his sword arm. Before things had the chance to turn ugly, however, Emban came along the hall.
Vanion? He exclaimed. And Sparhawk? When did you get back?
We only just arrived, Your Grace, Vanion replied. End of Side 12. Change Side Selector Switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.